My full name is John R. Garman. I go by Jack Garman. Jack's a nickname for John. So most people don't know that, but I remind them of Jack Kennedy.
You grew up in Chicago, was it?
Yeah, a suburb of Chicago, a couple of them. Born in a town called Oak Park, which is right outside Chicago, and grew up mostly in a town called Elmhurst. Both my parents met at the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. not Illinois, and that's where I ended up going. And when I went there, they did not have an undergraduate degree in computers, so I went into a specialty engineering program called engineering physics, which was the only program at the university that allowed a minor, which I took in computers. So I did kind of the equivalent. And when it got to be my senior year and you do all those interviews, the then called Manned Spacecraft Center, now called Johnson Space Center, was one of the interviewees. They probably offered the least money of all the interviews I got. Most of them were for Apollo, you know, for contractors and stuff like that. But I concluded I'd rather be on the inside than the outside, if you know what I mean, part of NASA, as opposed to part of one of the contractors. So I did it. I signed up with them, and it was pretty funny when I drove home from Ann Arbor, Michigan, to Chicago to pick up some stuff. That's not very far. I had no idea where Houston, Texas was. I just took off. I drove through Dallas, which is a long, long way, and got down to Houston. And even then, when I got to the center, I had no idea that we were located halfway between Houston and the Gulf of Mexico. I didn't realize it was almost next to Galveston, Texas. So anyway, that's how I got into the job. When I arrived there, they told me I could work on either the onboard computers, you know, the embedded computers in the Apollo spacecraft, mm-hmm. which were called AGCs, Apollo Guidance Computer, or I could work in the big Mission Control Center computers. Well, heck, which one side of Mars? So I ended up working for the organization at, even though it was called Manned Spacecraft Center, I'm going to call it the Johnson Space Center from now on. Mm-hmm. I worked in the organization at Johnson that was contracting out, being the customer for the onboard software, mm-hmm. which was being built by MIT.
Right.
By their instrumentation lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So I ended up traveling up there, probably twice a month. And you got to picture something. I was 21. Mm-hmm. I got through school pretty fast. You get this 21-year-old, green behind the ears fella, walking into these guys that are working like crazy on the Apollo onboard software. And they look at me and say, okay, what do you want to know? I was only half stupid. I said something like, I'm not sure. I'm kind of new at the game. Why don't you help me understand what I need to know? And that got me along pretty well with them. Well, in those days, even though the computers were, you know, you couldn't get anywhere without them, even in the Apollo spacecraft, they were viewed as fully embedded, part of guidance. And so in the Mission Control Center, they did not have, in the big, what they call MOCR, Mission Operations Control Room, the one you may remember seeing on all the TV with the consoles and all that.
Yep.
They did not have a position there for the onboard computers. And then it did later, without question, but for a lot of good reasons. But at that time, they did not. And they didn't have anybody that knew anything about computers. The one position in the control center that sort of owned the computers was called guidance, of course.
And that was down in the trenches.
Yeah, down in the trench, exactly. So they asked, if you believe it, the mission operations folks asked for help. And of course I was volunteered along with a couple of my colleagues. And they put us in a room they called the staff support room. And so there's several of them along. Each position in the main control room had a staff of people to advise them and help them in one of these side rooms. So that's where I was. And the position was called, imaginatively, AGC support. So I started sort of double timing. That is, I was both part of the developmental organization that was a customer to MIT, and I was an ad hoc member of the mission operations organization, which did the control center. So one of the things you were interested in was what the atmosphere was like in Houston and during the run-up to Apollo. And I could give you two sides of that. One is that I don't remember real clearly because I was totally buried. Hardly saw daylight. On the other hand, there was a lot of celebration about having astronauts and all that. I think it was the glamour of it more than the understanding the real technology. But everybody got treated well. All of us, young and old employees there, as well as astronauts and all that, very, very welcome in Houston. Lots of excitement and all that. So not a lot of anticipation or anything. Sort of like the, if you will, the crowds in the Coliseum watching the gladiators. You know? Not that we're killing each other, but, you know, taking chances.
Yes,
taking chances. So yeah.
And there were a lot of younger people too, weren't there, on the teams?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I think the average age in the control center at that time was like 27 or 28 years old. It was incredible.
Yeah.
For Apollo 11. By the time Apollo 11 happened, I was, 3 years later, 24. So I was on the younger side. But even the infamous people like Chris Kraft and Gene Kranz and all that, they were under 40. They were in their 30s.
Yeah.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
So you sometimes see movies of Mission Control where they're reenacting missions and there are all these old people in Mission Control, and you think, it wasn't like that, was it?
No. let me see. One of the interesting moments for me in watching all the Apollo missions was Apollo 8. Hmm. You know, the first time that human beings left Earth orbit. That's the one where they flew around the moon on Christmas Eve. I think that it was an extremely risky mission. There was a space race going on with the Russians, and the idea was to take a step ahead. They went with no lunar module, just the command module. And the notion, of course, is that the last stage of the Saturn launch vehicle stayed with the spacecraft. It was called the S-4B. And that vehicle, that rocket, relit. So the Saturn V took them to Earth orbit. And then the Saturn 4B relit and pushed them on to the trajectory to the moon. And one of the anecdotal stories I would like to share is that as they were coasting to the moon, which is a long and fairly boring period. Not boring, but not a lot going on. A number of us decided to take a bet on exactly when a light would light up on our consoles. This light was connected to a telemetry reading from the onboard computers that signaled when they determined that they were falling towards the moon instead of rising away from the Earth. In other words, when they escaped the Earth.
Yes.
And what the computers did is they changed coordinate systems.
Mm.
Instead of being Earth-centric, it became lunar-centric. Now you say to yourself, this is, what the heck? We knew exactly what time that was physically going to happen. but that wasn't the bet. The bet was on the light. Light was subject to speed of light delays, of telemetry, processing delays in the computers, and all that. And of course, I didn't win. I don't even remember who. But I got to tell you something. When that light came on, there was silence. It was kind of a dawning. Because that we were, you know, we were witnessing the first time that human beings were falling away from the earth. And it was, that was, I had several of those aha moments.
It really was such a pioneering mission, wasn't it?
Hell yeah, yeah, it really was. And, you know, you do so many simulations that are very realistic that when it comes time to do the real mission, you know, your mind isn't quite with it until something striking happens. You say, oh, yeah, this is real. It's happening. I mean, even though you knew it was real. So
You can hear it in the astronauts when they go behind the moon for the first time and they have loss of signal.
Oh, yeah.
At exactly the moment predicted. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. And, of course, we knew if they were going to make it back home, that is, if the burn to take them out of lunar orbit, which took place on the back of the moon, we knew if they were going to make it home by when we got AOS, acquisition of signal.
Mm-hmm.
If it came soon, it meant they were going faster. It meant the burn was probably successful. If it came late, uh-oh.
Not good.
It came a little late. It came a little late, but that was just a prediction problem. So everything was fine. That made some people. But, you know, those folks were more isolated behind the moon than you can possibly be.
Yeah.
There's nothing. No telemetry, no nothing. And they saw something that no human being had ever seen, the back of the moon. It was kind of awesome.
So what was the state of the navigation software when Apollo 8 went? Because the mission didn't have a very long lead time, did it?
No, but the all that software was under incremental development, and it was being developed for Apollo 11, for the lunar landing.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, you know, and they were, those flights were just months apart. So they had a version of the... And they didn't have the lunar module software. They didn't need it. They just needed the command module software. So it was pretty much the same software that flew on Apollo 11, you know, with no problems that I recall. So you want to talk about Apollo 11 a little?
If you like, yeah. Is there anything in particular for 9 or 10, or should we go straight to 11?
I think that both 9 and 10 were fun. I mean, the... 9 was the lunar module flight, basically, around Earth orbit, and had a number of little problems, glitches, but it all worked out. And, of course, Apollo 10 was a landing that didn't take place on purpose. You know, they went to the moon and back.